Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Photojournalists working for the Associated Press capture 3,000 images every day around the globe. These are the memorable photos you see in newspapers, magazines, and online. They tell stories about everything from war and political clashes to natural disasters and human interest stories. Just this morning, I was looking at the photo of James Holmes, the suspect in the Colorado Theater massacre. He appeared in a Colorado courtroom today with red orange hair and large eyes. It's a piercing photo, and you can't help but wonder what he's thinking about. You'll most likely see that same photo all over the internet today. It was taken by an Associated Press photographer, and it'll probably appear on the cover of newspapers across the country tomorrow. Do you ever wonder who is behind the camera or what it takes to get the right photo? The new documentary Deadline Every Second follows 12 of the world's top AP photographers on assignment from Wall Street to Gaza. Here's Santiago Lyon, director of photography at the AP, talking about the pressures involved in getting the right shot.
An AP photographer can't mess up. An AP photographer has to come back with something usable at the end of the day. So the challenge often is reconciling those two things. You have to get something good in the can, as it were, but you also, if you want to be successful, have to take a chance and do something different.
And that's a clip from Deadline Every Second. The film airs tomorrow night on PBS at 11 p.m. right after Frontline. Ken Cobrey, the producer of the film, hopes it will change the way you look at news images. Ken Cobrey follows a dozen AP photographers through 9 cities in the U.S., Europe, and the Middle East. The AP sends out 1 million news pictures a year to over 3 billion readers. Ken is professor of photo and video journalism at San Francisco State and the author of Photojournalism, The Professional's Approach, and more recently of Video Journalism, Multimedia Storytelling. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Hello. It's good to talk to you.
It's great to have you. And we are also joined by Tara Tadros-Whitehill. She's an American photojournalist who has worked extensively in Egypt and is now with the AP in Israel and the West Bank. She is a specialist in women's issues but has worked in all general assignment phases. In 2011, she filed from Cairo during the overthrow of the Mubarak regime. Hi, Tara. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's nice to be here. Actually, just one thing. I'm no longer with the AP.
Oh.
I quit in January, and I'm based in Cairo now.
Oh, okay. Well, the Deadline Every Second, we'll have to update your bio.
Exactly.
Well, so are you freelancing now, or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
oh, interesting. Well, we'll definitely talk about that later on the show. So, Ken, let's talk about why you decided to make this documentary. You believe that those of us who see photos on a regular basis just really take them for granted, and we're not really aware of what it takes to actually get the right photo.
Yes, I think that people see hundreds of photos these days, both in their newspaper, their magazine, and on the internet. And the photos stream by, and the photos are often quite amazing, and yet the story behind them never comes out. And we never quite understand who it is that took the picture or what it took to get those pictures. This becomes particularly important because the attitude towards journalism and photojournalism has been getting worse and worse over the last few years. And I think one of the reasons is because people really don't have an appreciation for what goes into grabbing those photos.
And what makes you think that?
Well, first of all, I've been the first to have been allowed to follow these photographers on assignment. So I'm the first to actually be able to show people what was going on behind the scenes. And secondly, my experience of talking to students and how surprised they are at the energy that it takes and the cleverness and the drive that it takes to make the kind of photographs that you see every day.
Tara, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think people take the photos you capture on a regular basis for granted?
Yeah, I think they do. And I also think that they get taken out of context a lot. People use them for their, you know, whatever they think the story is. And they, you know, they attribute a lot to the photo. They'll say, oh, this was taken from a certain angle, or she's not really covering the story, or like this isn't what was really there. And they just, there's a lot of background that they're obviously missing in, you know, and, you know, falsehoods as well when they say stuff like that.
And can you give us an example, maybe one of the photos that you took that some of us may have seen?
Well, it's not just me. I mean, especially in Israel and the West Bank, where everything is highly, very critically looked at by both sides. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times there's websites devoted just to pointing out inaccuracies, and sometimes they'll not just point out inaccuracies, and they'll go so far as to say, oh, well, you know, that was like putting the gun in the frame, and you didn't have to put it there. It's so centered and right next to the person, and, you know, if it wasn't there, then we wouldn't be able to take that photo. You know, and so there's definitely a lot of criticism. I mean, everyone I know, especially there, has gotten some sort of feedback, bad feedback from people because of the tension there and how focused the world is on it.
Right. And is this something that you pay attention to? And if so, do you respond?
I pay attention by being really careful about, I mean, I'm always careful about the images that I take, but, you know, especially there, you know, I was very, very careful to get the backstory for anything and make sure that I wasn't being fed something, you know, as well, so that I was very aware of, you know, how important those photos would be to other people. And so I was, you know, interviewing as well as taking the photo to make sure I wasn't getting something that was faked.
Right. And I'd love to talk to you about what's involved, especially, I mean, there are scenes of you taking photos in the middle of, you know, you've got Palestinians throwing stones, and then you have the Israeli military firing off tear gas and rubber bullets, and the photographers are sort of running in all sorts of different directions. And I'd love to talk to you about that and just what's involved in that. But before we do that, Ken, talk a little bit more about what it took to make this film and why you think it's so important to really talk about photojournalism. You believe that, and I never thought about this before, but you believe that photography is thrown in with the paparazzi. Can you talk about that?
Well, that's an important problem because we use the same cameras as a paparazzi, but the whole point of what we're doing is completely different. The paparazzi are just after celebrities. Each paparazzi picture is going to make them a lot of money. They're really not interested in trying to tell a story or reveal truth or get at the news, whereas photojournalists, on the other hand, are very much storytellers trying to explain to the world what's going on. So I think that even though the equipment is the same, the whole point of doing it is very different. And so what I set out to do was try to take the reader on a trip so that they would see the photographer as they were actually recording what they were seeing. And often you've probably seen a photographer after they've taken the great picture talk about it, but what I wanted to be there, I wanted to be present when it was actually happening. And so when I took photographs of these photographers, including Tara, they were mic'd. They actually had a mic on them, so you could hear what they were saying. You could hear what they were thinking. You could watch what they were doing. And then in the end, you could see the actual picture that they produced. And in Tara's case, I was actually there when a policeman in Israel pulled Tara off a column and threw her to the ground. And it was just a remarkably shocking moment to see that take place. And maybe she can talk about a little bit what that experience was like for her.
Yeah, Tara, why don't you tell us about that?
It was the week before the Holy Fire, which is one of the big events in Jerusalem, and it's the Orthodox. I believe it was the Orthodox Palm Friday, but I don't remember exactly. But it was a big. It's a lot of pilgrims in the church, and you sometimes, as photographers, stand on the pillars. And it wasn't just me, and I've done it before, but this particular policeman just decided he had it in for me, and he kind of decided that he was going to get me off that pillar, and I was going to go the other way off just to get away from him, but he didn't want that, so he pulled me off the pillar and kind of like threw me down. I mean, I landed on my feet, and then he's like, get out, shame on you. And I turned around and I yelled at him, shame on me, shame on you. And then walked right past him back into the church because I knew that he couldn't actually physically throw me out of the church. He wasn't allowed. So I made a point of walking right past him back into the church to take more pictures.
When people see that particular incident, the thing that amazes them is not just what Tara had to go through to get the picture, but also how cool she was that she walked back into that church after that terrible incident and then started taking pictures again as if nothing had happened. And that's what makes her the great photojournalist that she is.
Well, and after being handled by, I think it was, what, 4 or 5 of these guys?
Yeah, I mean, it happens a lot in the photojournalism profession, so you get kind of used to it. And you also know where the limits are. You know, obviously, in another context, another country, they could have probably really thrown me out. But I knew enough. I'd been there for long enough, and I knew that that was not, they were not allowed to do that. And I knew I was allowed to do what I was doing. So, you know, I had that knowledge of me. Like, you know, other people, other photographers might have responded differently. I knew that I could go back into the church. So,
and Tara, when you're covering Israel and Palestine, I mean, it was really interesting in the film. Two of your colleagues were also in the film, and we'll hear a clip from Khalil Hamra. He's an AP staffer in Gaza. And he was talking about trying to get past the stereotypes with his photos. That was one of his main goals. What's one of your main goals when you're out on the streets trying to tell this story?
Well, I think partially as a woman, I tried to find the women. I think that a lot of times women are sort of on the side, so they are not in the middle of a photo, and you have to actually go in search of them. So for me, I always try to find the stories that are not necessarily front and center, but also the ones that need to be told because they're part of it. And another thing that I definitely try to do is to show a larger context, because sometimes you can have a small crowd of people yelling and screaming, but it's only like 20 people. And so it's not really what's happening if it's not that big. So I always try to... It's harder to get a photo that is like shows the context that's not as sexy, not always as sexy. And so you have to work harder to get a photo that shows what's really going on.
And how much say do you have once you submit these photos to your editors? If you want the sort of non-sexy photo because it tells the real story, are you able to express that?
I think it depends a lot on the photographer's ability to get that photo and make it an interesting photo. I mean, I can't just send a photo that's uninteresting and expect it to get in.
Right.
I have to find something else that makes that photo interesting, whether it's someone's hand movement or, you know, the color of a hijab or whatever it is that's going to change that photo. Like, I can't expect that just because I send a photo, it will get in because I want it to. It has to be a good photo as well.
Well, let's hear a clip from your colleague. This is Khalil Hamra, an Associated Press staffer in Gaza.
I love some of the pictures on the beach. It shows the water and doesn't show faces, just show human beings having fun. And a lot of people, especially in Europe, likes to see the other side of Gaza, the daily life. Like how people live. If you go deep to these people, for sure you will find like big, huge sadness. But we are lucky to have this beach.
And that is Khalil Hamra. He's an AP staffer in Gaza in the film Deadline Every Second. He said, I love taking pictures of the beach because it shows human beings just having fun. And Europeans, he said, like to see the other side of Gaza. Can you talk about that, Tara? I mean, it's so interesting because you have such an opportunity to show something other than what we usually see, and that is children running down the street throwing stones. I mean, that's pretty much what we see when you see a photo of Palestinians, for example.
Yeah, I mean, Jose Khalil is an amazing photographer, and he's, you know, incredibly skilled at telling a full story. So he knows very, like, you know, he's exactly right that the beach and daily life is incredibly important, especially in that context, because, you know, you want to show something that's not what is expected, but you, and you still have an obligation to do that too, because it's not enough to just show the protests. It's about what goes on, you know, every day for, you know, the Gazans, for Palestinians, for the Israelis, for everyone. You know, his stuff, I mean, he was just recently in Syria, and his amazing photos from Syria, and a lot of it was just very, very down moments, like not the shooting, the fighting. So
that is Tara Todres-Whitehill. She's an American journalist, photojournalist, who's worked extensively in Egypt, Israel, and the West Bank. She left the AP in January. She's now based in Cairo. And last year, she filed from Cairo during the overthrow of the Mubarak regime. We're also joined by Ken Cobry. He's producer of the documentary Deadline Every Second. It follows 12 of the world's top AP photographers on assignment from Wall Street to Gaza. And the film airs tomorrow night on PBS at 11 p.m. right after Frontline. And we'd love to hear from you. As Ken said, he feels like so many of us take photos for granted. When you see a photo, do you ever think about who took the photo, what it took to get that shot? I was staring this morning at the photo of James Holm, the suspect in the Colorado theater massacre. And this one photo was taken by an AP photojournalist. It'll most likely end up on the front page of newspapers around the country tomorrow, and maybe even some international papers. So what sort of emotions spark? What sort of emotions do you get when you see a photograph? And do you take photographs for granted? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. What is the last memorable photograph you saw, and how did it change the way you see a news event, whether it's a natural disaster or war? 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ruby in Mill Valley. Hi, Ruby. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Good morning. I have such, I'm so fascinated by behind the scenes stuff. And I'm always interested in what that's all about. How did things get taken? So my question is, what happens on a slow news day? Do the AP photographers have to file every day? And if so, what do they do if there's nothing really going on? Do they, I mean, they certainly can't make up the news. And then, also, how do you become an AP photographer? What, you know, do you just audition, or, I mean, how hard is it to become that?
All right, thank you for that. Ken, what are your thoughts on this? I don't know if a slow news day exists, but, for example, if you're based somewhere, obviously there's a slow news day. How do you deal with that?
Well, first of all, the AP as an organization has 600 photographers, so there's always news somewhere, but it might not be in your bureau.
Right.
And second of all, you're going out often on routine assignments with reporters who are covering whatever the news is for the day. And a lot of the news is press conferences and things that aren't as exciting. Now, it just so happens that the Israeli Jerusalem Bureau is one of the most intense bureaus in the world, and that that's the reason I went there to see what they did. And while it's true that you don't see clashes every day, it so happens that the first day I arrived, they said that the whole thing was blowing up, and I had not expected that. And when I went in, they handed me a flak jacket and a helmet, and they sent me out to the front lines on the very first day I arrived for me to start covering the action there. But I'm sure that doesn't go on every day. And so often what AP photographers do is they look for what we call feature pictures, pictures that will tell you a little bit about the general life that's there, certainly the life that's going on in Israel is certainly visually very interesting, with the Orthodox Jews as well as the Arabs and all intermingling. And perhaps Tara also might talk a little bit about what happens on the, on those days.
Tara?
Yes, I'm here. Sorry. Hello?
Yeah, would you like to talk about what happens on a daily basis when you're in a place like the West Bank? Ruby was talking about what happens on a slow news day.
Yeah, I mean, I think Ken is completely right. There's obviously, you know, the news is never slow in the entire world, but in your particular office, there's definitely slow news days. You know, less so in places like Israel and the West Bank, although it goes through its own cycles too. But there's always things that, you know, you might not be interested in, but maybe one of the subscribers is interested in. So you have to go photograph the prime minister of a small country that you think no one has heard of, but we have subscribers there. So, you know, those are kind of the things that, especially in a place like Israel and the West Bank, that's very important to get those photos for a particular country's newspaper. So there's fewer days like that, but there still are. And then, you know, it's up to you to go and find something interesting to photograph. And when you're in a place like, you know, through Jerusalem, there's always the old city. There's always something kind of new and different. And you really just have to push yourself on those days to really come up with a different photo.
Well, and I'd like to ask our next guest the same question. Bobito Matthews has been with the AP for nearly 20 years, and he's covered presidential conventions, volcanoes, the Olympics, Princess Diana's funeral, the 9/11 aftermath, and professional sports in the West Indies. His long-term project, Sophia, about a child suffering from a rare bone disorder, won a top multimedia award from the Society of Professional Journalists, and he joins us from the AP office in New York. Hi, Bobito. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So Ruby just called in and wanted to find out what it's like on a slow news day. And because you've got 600 photographers around the world, that really doesn't happen. But talk a little bit about just what the average day is like. I mean, we're talking about 3,000 images per day. That's a lot of photographs.
Yeah, and you know, that's a lot of photographs coming from overseas and nationally. You know, locally, what I'm concerned with is what goes on in New York City. I'm not so much traveling to bureaus anymore. Nor do we really do that anymore. So on a down day in New York, I guess that's the question, right? When it's a slow news day, what goes on?
Right.
Yeah. On a slow news day, we take advantage of a slow news day. You know, we've got electronic gear, and we have to refresh our gear so we can go back out and shoot. And in a busy city like New York, there could be a host of daily life features, which is something that we hardly get an opportunity to work on because we have so much of the city hall, the spot news stuff that goes with our with our daily report stuff that we do here. But in between that, you know, we go around the city just to try to see what the life of New York is like and provide that for our members.
And Bobito, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking today about the new documentary Deadline Every Second. It airs tomorrow night on PBS at 11 p.m. right after Frontline. It follows 12 of the world's top AP photographers. What do you think makes a great photo? What image moved you recently? 866-798-8255. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
Hello, this is Chuck Finney of Your Legal Rights. We're having a Call a Lawyer night this Wednesday evening starting at 7. If you have legal questions for Off the Air, please call 1-800-525-9917. On the air, on Your Legal Rights, the topic will be social networking issues in the workplace. My guests will be employment law attorneys Tyler Petko and Olga Savage. That's this Wednesday evening at 7 for Call a Lawyer night and Your Legal Rights here at 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We'll be right back.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also sign up for our new newsletter there to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Hugh Sinclair, author of Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic, How Microlending Lost Its Way and Betrayed the Poor. A former insider, he argues that with few exceptions, the $70 billion microlending industry is filled with corruption and is doing far more harm than good. So we'll speak with Hugh Sinclair about his new book tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us to talk about today's show about photojournalism and just what is the value of photojournalism in this ever-changing media landscape? What makes a great photo? What photo has moved you recently? And what photo do you remember? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We have a comment from Ron in San Francisco who says, I am often moved by news photos throughout the newspaper. What is disturbing is to have the San Francisco Chronicle arrive at my front door with stick-on ads pasted across the photo. The effect, of course, is already diminished, but peeling off the ad often negatively affects the quality. Photojournalist work needs to be better respected. Thank you for the email, Ron. And if you've got a comment about photojournalism and what it means to you, how does it affect you when you see a photo on the front page of the newspaper or a photo on an online news website? 866-798-8255. And do you agree with Ken Cobry, the producer of Deadline Every Second, that most of us are really unaware of what it takes to do photojournalism, and we often take photos for granted? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on yourcallradio.org. Ken is producer of the film Deadline Every Second, which airs tomorrow night on PBS at 11 p.m. He followed 12 of the world's top photographers on assignment from Wall Street to Gaza, including Tara Todres Whitehill. She's an American photojournalist who has worked extensively in Egypt, Israel, and the West Bank. We're also joined by Bobito Matthews. He's been with the AP for nearly 20 years, covering everything from presidential conventions to the aftermath of 9/11. And Bobito, before the break, you were talking about an average day in New York City.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the average day actually centers around, you know, we have priorities, news priorities. There's a meeting that takes place at around 9 in the morning, and it kind of defines, you know, what we're going to cover as news in the city. And we try to illustrate those stories. You know, our staff is reduced. We're in the age now where we're doing more with less. So we can end up having 2-3 assignments a day, as opposed to maybe one on average, you know, in years past. You know, it's mostly political. And actually, you know, we complain a lot how press releases tend to drive some of what we cover. but generally, we go after the news of the day because we have to provide a package for our members that's cross-platform, you know, for the stories that we put out. So that's a priority. Now, within the scope of that, yes, you're always, as a photojournalist, you know, looking for your moment. You know, your personal mind's eye have a way you look at scenes. No matter how often we go to these events, whether they're at City Hall or you know, or the governor's office, or it's a protest rally or whatever. You know, we're always looking into it for something a little bit different. But you asked something about a picture that may have moved me recently. And normally I don't like to think of images like that, but I did. It's funny you should ask. We have an intern here this summer. We have two interns. Our internship program restarted after being on hiatus for 2 years, budget reasons. And so we have two interns here in our New York bureau this year, and they're part of our new, we're stressing now that our interns have experience across all our platforms, video, photo, words. And Faye Abulghazem, I don't want to mess up her last name. She's from the Sudan. And I'm supervising her photo internship here. And she went out a couple of days ago and worked on a story concerning the first year gay marriage, first year anniversary here in the city. And was a bit nervous going out on that story. She had to work it on her own and, you know, find some moments. She came back with an image of hands of two individuals just holding hands, and a knee shot, available light, just a beautiful, warm, tender moment. And it reminded me of the power of photojournalism when you mm-hmm. think, when you approach the work with thoughtfulness, when you look at that landscape, you know, that human landscape, and you find a moment that reads with clarity, that's compelling, that's interesting, and looks nothing like what the citizen journalist can do as a snapshot. Mm-hmm. And this is where we are today in photojournalism. You know, we've lost the spot news to social media and citizen journalism. But you know, the era where real journalism takes place, where visual intellect shows itself. Now we're challenged to produce in that way, show the thoughtfulness that goes behind this work. And
remind us, though, of some of the important pictures that AP has taken, particularly the picture right after 9/11 of the human body falling, taken by Richard Drew, and the impact that had. And in fact, it had so much impact that after it was shown, right after 9/11, it wasn't shown again almost until 10 years later. And then, only then, could people be willing to look at that amazing picture of the person falling from the tower.
You know, that was striking. Richard Drew, 37 years as an AP photojournalist, he was actually shooting a fashion show when he got a call about planes hitting the building. He got chilling photos of people jumping out of the building, and he talks about the falling man, where his head is just going straight down. You know, I wanted to ask you actually about this, Ken, because Richard says, you know, my job is to sort of take the photo without emotion. This is my job. And my first reaction was, how can you not have emotion when you're taking photos of people jumping out of a building?
Now, it's interesting. Out of all the photographers I've interviewed, I've heard this answer over and over under all conditions. And what I think is taking place is, during the moment they're professionals, and during the moment this action is taking place, there is a shutoff valve. And the emotional valve gets shut down, and the professional valve gets turned on, and they're able to do their job in spite of what's going on around them. And that's one of the things, that's an example of what separates them from the citizen journalist or the average person or whatever. The average person would be so horrified that they would not be able to function. But the truth is that Richard had been practicing taking pictures for the AP for years before that picture was taken. So he was an experienced person when the moment took place. And I think we underestimate that, because even though the camera is the same camera someone else might use, he, as a professional, was a highly trained professional and knew what to do in that moment. First to get the picture, and then to save his own life.
Well, and then you've got, for example, Mario Sanchez. And Bobito, I'm glad you brought up gay marriage, because Mario spent 8 years on AP and has covered stories worldwide. He was covering the crowd in San Francisco awaiting the California Supreme Court's decision on gay marriage. He said it was one of the most visual stories he's ever covered. And Ken, Mario spent the day taking photos of such a diverse range of people, holding their kids, hugging, carrying signs. And then the court overturned, or they ruled against proponents of gay marriage. Three people got arrested. And in that moment, he was tearing up, saying, you know, I had such amazing photos showing the emotional side of it. but my editor is going to want a photo of the arrests, and it's just three people getting arrested.
Well, I think that's also what Carol was saying, and the question is, how do you put a single picture in perspective? So if you're going to run one picture from an event, and often that's all a newspaper will run or a magazine, is it the picture of people crying, or is it the picture of people getting arrested? Now, certainly people did get arrested, so that certainly was news. You can't argue with that. But to miss the emotional element of what was going on is also there. And I think that in print, it's so difficult when it comes down to one picture. Now, in my opinion is that the Internet has given us the golden age of photojournalism because we no longer have to just see one picture. We can see multiple pictures from an event like that. The important thing to me from what I was trying to do was see that, in fact, Mario Sanchez Marcio was, in fact, very emotional. He really, really, really felt deeply about the event itself, and that had an impact. But that didn't stop his shooting. His shooting remained professional and showed all sides of what was going on.
Well, and also, a photograph can contrast the story and bring in a completely different perspective.
Right. You never...
Bobito.
Yeah, that is true. You know, oftentimes the picture gives us a broader context, a greater understanding of the event and the moment. And, you know, what we do here at AP, at an event like the one Mario attended, we're going to file a number of images that covers what we saw while we were there. When you get to our members, it's always interesting to me, and I'll spend some time on a downtime just looking through what our members publish across the country. And, you know, yeah, oftentimes I can see where the reach is for the police action moment in those events, you know. But then I look at, papers like the New York Times, Washington Post, And primarily on the online side, I think there's a different editors work differently on these publications. The online seem to have a different lead picture on a story like that. You know, oftentimes they'll go more with the emotional texture of the event as opposed to say the newspaper that has, as Ken say, you know, just the space for that one picture. They're going for the thing that kind of impacts readers as they pass by and see that top fold. So, yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention, this disengagement that occurs with professionals. You know, we understand what our role is as photojournalists. You know, we're making records for society to really understand and understand who what society is all about. And so it's really important to understand what your professional responsibility is at a moment when something breaks. That's what you live for. That's why you're there, and that's your job. So yeah, there is a disengagement that occurs. I, as far as emotions, we are human beings. And I've been in situations where I've felt for my subject. I've needed to extend help to my subjects while I'm working. And you find that balance. It's funny. The camera. It's probably the only tool. It's an extension of your eye. You can't help but put some of your emotion into the work at times. You know, it probably directs where you turn your lens.
Well, I want to point out one thing about pictures, and that is that people believe pictures. When they read copy, they always wonder if the writer made it somehow different or tipped it in some different way or had an attitude. But people, no matter what you tell them, believe their eyes, and that's the power of photojournalism, and almost nothing can take that away. Even if you tell people that the picture has been photoshopped or something, it's almost impossible for them to overcome the fact that they believe what they see. And that is really what we have to show with photojournalism.
Tara, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I just wanted to add something about the detachment, because I'm originally from New York, and when 9/11 happened, I hadn't chosen photojournalism as my concentration and what I wanted to do. And I was in the same boat as most people, where I didn't have any desire to pick up a camera. And then when I decided that I wanted to do photojournalism and I moved to the Middle East, and the first day I moved to the Middle East was Lebanon, Beirut, the day that Rafiq Hariri was assassinated. And there was this moment, literally 12 hours after I got off a plane, where I had to decide, when I heard that massive explosion, which way to run, towards the explosion or away from the explosion. And when I got there and I lifted that camera and I knew that we didn't know at that point that it was Rafiq Hariri. We just knew that there were burned bodies and there was this huge hole in the ground and shattered windows, and it was ridiculous. But, I mean, I didn't sell any photos that day, but what I realized about myself that day was that I could do this. And I think that that's definitely something that not everyone can do. But you can, come from, I didn't have any desire when 9/11 happened to go take photos at all.
And going to Ruby's question, how does someone become an AP photographer? So did you start out as a freelancer? Did you have mentors to sort of show you the ropes? What was that process like?
I did have mentors. There were a lot of great photographers that I saw in New York City that always gave me advice as I was going on the way. But I decided by myself to move to the Middle East. And in fact, it was long before I became an AP photographer. It was Santiago Leon's suggestion to get out of New York City. And so I decided that I wanted to focus on women's issues, and I moved to a region where that was much more of a newsworthy item. And, it is everywhere, but, the Middle East has a lot of different issues about women. And So I moved there and, Beirut and then Cairo, and all the photojournalists there were really, really great and very helpful. And very quickly started working for different agencies. And
that is Tara Tadros-Whitehill. She's an American photojournalist who has worked extensively, as you just heard, in the Middle East, Egypt, Israel, and the West Bank. And her work is featured in the new documentary Deadline Every Second, which follows 12 of the world's top AP photographers on assignment from Wall Street to Gaza. We're also joined by Bebito Matthews. He's been working with the AP for nearly 20 years, covering everything from the 9/11 aftermath to the Olympics, presidential convention, volcanoes. And Ken Cobry is the producer of the film. It'll air tomorrow night on PBS at 11 p.m. right after Frontline. We've got just over 5 minutes left. If you'd like to get in a comment or a question about photojournalism, we have a number of emails. I'll read those in just a minute. What makes a great photograph? What's the last photograph you remember? And what does a photo do that a story might not be able to do? Do you think we take these photos for granted? 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. For some reason, we're getting so many emails today. I don't know what it is. It's interesting. I'll read them in just a minute, but let's take a phone call. Let's hear from Neil. Hi, Neil. Welcome to the show.
Well, hi, Rose, and hi to your guests. I grew up in the era of the great photo magazines, Life and the Copycat Look, and I was very strongly influenced by the power of those images, both single images and also the photo essays. And I'm thinking of like Eugene Smith and the Minimata and things like that. And I wanted to be a photographer, and I had a chance to be a photojournalist for a short time in the 1970s and 80s. And I guess the highlight of my little short career was going to the West Bank during the first Intifada. And I collaborated with a writer named Phyllis Bennis on a book about the Intifada. And our approach was a little bit different than the daily kind of photojournalist. We didn't just chase after the flashpoints or the bang-bang, which, the press always wants to see, the conflict flashpoints. We tried to tell a story about what were the motivations of the Palestinians and what was their daily life like under occupation, what were their aspirations, and so forth. And we felt that that story could only really be told in a book. At the same time, if I got a great picture that had news value, I would bring it into AP and sell it to them, and I would see it appear, in the press the next day. But our ultimate goal was to produce this book, and we did a book called From Stones to Statehood, and the designer who did the book had an interesting approach. He was influenced by the work of Jean Maure and Jean Berger, who felt that people should look at photographs without being told what to look at by the caption. And so all the photos were, appeared in the book without the captions. They were all placed at the end, and that gave the reader the possibility to look into the photograph and derive their own meaning without being told what to, how to understand and read the picture. And I think that's still a shortcoming of photojournalism today. I know myself, when I see a picture, I automatically will go look at the caption before I try to read the picture. And I have to almost force myself to look at the picture first and understand what is it saying to me.
Mm. Well, and also, what are your thoughts on photos of that we get from Israel and Palestine? I was just struck by Khalil Harma in Gaza basically saying, I want to show regular life. I want to show the other side of Gaza that most people don't see.
Well, I think that in terms of the daily publications, people aren't really interested in those kind of inside stories. They want to see the exciting, dramatic pictures. But there is a need for those pictures. I'm not sure if I feel that they have the impact that they used to have in the era of the great photo magazines. Mm. I think that the impact of photojournalism has been somewhat diluted by the web and by video coverage and the rise of citizen journalism. I mean, there's so much more out there, but where are the great images? Newsweek is not a great magazine, but I get it weekly, and I do look at they have two or three pictures in there, and I still feel that they have a lot of impact.
Yeah. Well, we're getting a slew of emails, so clearly they've got impact. I want to read a few, and then we'll get responses. Eugene writes in and says, the best book I have read lately on photojournalism is The Abu Ghraib Effect by Stephen Eisman. Eisman argues that the complexity of violent and sexual motifs found in the photographs constitutes the Abu Ghraib effect, an instance of a long-standing Western pathos formula whereby victims are shown taking pleasure in their own chastisement and pain. Thank you for that one. He also says John Tagg's books are all great, The Burden of Representation, Essays on Photos and History. Thanks for those recommendations, Eugene. Chuck says, this might not fit with your discussion, but I'm thinking about the phenomena of citizen reporting, like CNN's iReport and other ad hoc YouTube stuff. Compare and contrast. Right place, right time, adequate equipment versus the efforts and planning that folks like the AP do. Thank you for the email, Chuck. Carol writes, photos often tell more than the articles that go with them. Who can forget the photo of the little girl, her skin burning with napalm, dropped on her by U.S. planes, running and crying? Who can forget the photo of the Kent State student, her arms outstretched, crying over the body of a fellow student killed by Ohio National Guardsmen, or dogs set on children marching for civil rights in Birmingham, or Gaza children bombed by Israel? All of these photos, including the one in today's New York Times, of the Afghan man on a donkey riding past the site of a mass grave, connect us, at least in some kind of partial understanding, of people far away. Since we are connected with these photos, because the U.S. government, which we pay taxes, drops bombs and invades these countries, we need to see them and their lands. Thank you, photojournalists, who let us see. And Carol, I'm so glad you brought up the photo of the little girl running in Vietnam, because Al Jazeera English recently interviewed her about that photo, and it's amazing. Kind of gives me the chills to hear her talk about seeing that photo, and as an adult, what kind of woman she's become. And I'll make sure to put a link to that photo right after the show. Ken, what are your thoughts on some of the comments we got? Julie Jacobson comes to mind because you also feature her. She was in Afghanistan, and she took a photo of a soldier who was killed, and the AP ran with the photo and then received a phone call from Secretary of Gates asking them not to use the photo.
Yes, this is an important incident because the government was trying to shut down the free press, and the government was trying to stop the Associated Press from sending out that picture. And the short version is that they had sent the picture to the parents, and the parents had then called Gates and tried to get him to turn around and stop the Associated Press from sending the picture. But the importance of the picture is that there have been very few pictures of soldiers actually being killed in either in Afghanistan or Iraq. And this was one of the few where a photojournalist was actually there when this took place. And the shocking thing is that the government would try to not let that happen. Now, the AP went ahead and sent that out in spite of their attempts. And that's a little bit different than the picture of the falling man from the World Trade Center. In that case, newspapers and magazines themselves self-censored. They quit running that picture. So in that case, they were the censors, but in the case of Afghanistan, it was the government trying to stop.
And how often does that happen, Ken, self-censorship? Do you know?
Well, that's a very, very hard thing to measure, because on every photographer, on every day, on every way, they're taking pictures and then they're not taking pictures. They're choosing to shoot and not shoot.
Right.
And that whole process then goes what they edit, what they choose. If they've taken 1,000 pictures, you're not going to see 1,000.
Well, so, and just the process is amazing. 3,000 photos, they go to the AP and then they send them out to the partners, and then the editors of the newspaper decides which one to choose, and then that ends up on our front doorstep for those of us who still subscribe. And Ken, in our remaining 30 seconds, what is in store for the future of photojournalism?
Well, I like to think of this as the golden age of photojournalism, because you're seeing more photojournalism than ever before. But economically, it's the worst thing that's ever happened to photojournalism, because people are paying less and less per picture, and it's harder and harder to be an independent photojournalist, a freelancer these days.
Mm. And as Julie Jacobson said in the film, it's important to see what's happening and to see the cost of war, and these photos can really shape our views about things like war and occupation. Ken Cobrey is producer of Deadline Every Second. It airs tomorrow night on PBS at 11 p.m. Tara Todres-Whitehill is an American journalist who's worked extensively in the Middle East, and Bibita Matthews has been with the AP for nearly 20 years. And you can find out more about the film at yourcallradio.org. Ken, Tara, and Bibita, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, and thank you for your emails and phone calls. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening at Your Call, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. Who benefits from microfinance? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Hugh Sinclair, author of Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic, How Microlending Lost Its Way and Betrayed the Poor. Sinclair argues that with a few exceptions, the $70 billion industry is filled with corruption. So what do you want to know about how this industry operates? Have you donated money to a microfinancing institution? What will it take to ensure they actually help the poor? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
Hello, this is Chuck Finney of Your Legal Rights. We're having a Call a Lawyer night this Wednesday evening starting at 7. If you have legal questions for Off the Air, please call 1-800-525-9917. On the air, on Your Legal Rights, the topic will be social networking issues in the workplace. My guests will be employment law attorneys Tyler Pateko and Olga Savage. That's this Wednesday evening at 7 for Call a Lawyer night and Your Legal Rights here at 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
Hello, Ben James here. Welcome to World Have Your Say on the BBC.
Given the nature of the charges, you are currently being held on a no-bond hold. You also have a right to have a jury trial and preliminary hearing to determine whether there's probable cause to believe that you're the person that committed the offense.
We're starting back in Colorado with the suspect in the Aurora shootings in court today. You're talking about whether this sort of mass killing can ever be prevented. Is there any better way of detecting people who might carry out such an attack? Is the availability of guns really the issue? You've already been talking about that on facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay. We'll reflect your comments through the programme. Also, Oprah Winfrey's film about India. One commentator says it's unflattering, outmoded, selective and cliched. What's your reaction?